Oh. Rylan's stomach fluttered. She wondered if it had been V or someone else involved in that whole twisted mess. She didn't want to know. Maybe it would be better if she did just dive right in. Listen, here I'll...
Rye,
he cut her off. I need you to do something for me. Once upon a time she would have agreed on the spot, but now she knew better.
What is it? She asked carefully.
I need you to help me post bail.
She started to laugh at the absurdity of it, but Hirul scowled, and she fell silent. God, he was serious. He leaned his elbows on the table, his forehead in his hands.
My stash is at the lifty entrance to the sea line on 17.
His eyes were still closed, his shoulders hunched in apparent defeat.
Hirul!
She hissed, panicked. What if the table was bugged? But he just went on, speaking in low, rapid tones.
It's fine. Put your hand on my shoulder. They don't actually listen in. I just don't want them to see my mouth, use lip read or anything.
Rylan did as he said, her heart hammering. Anyone looking in would think he was overwhelmed, hanging his head in his hands, and she was comforting him. His fists were almost at his chin, blocking his mouth from view.
The sea line on 17, he went on, behind the left side mech panel. I need you to clear it out. All of it. Don't leave anything there, especially not the Anderton spokes. V will reach out to you soon to set up a time and place for the handoff. Give everything to him. It should be enough to cover my bail. Mainly thanks to you, sealing those spokes, he added.
Rylan was speechless. Had Hirul really amassed 15,000 nanodollars of drugs? When had that happened?
Hirul, you know I can't, she said slowly.
Not with Krissa. If I get caught, she ends up in foster care. His eyes hardened and he looked up sharply.
So the rest of us can risk jail all the time, but you're too good for it?
I'm sorry. Rylan tried to keep her voice even. What about V? He could handle it.
You know he can't get into the locker room. Besides, I only trust you with this.
Hirul, please.
Do you want me to stay in here? Is that it?
He snarled, his face reddening.
Of course not, but...
Damn it, Rye!
Hirul slammed his fist on the table. She jolted back, but he grabbed her wrist with an iron grip.
You're going to do this for me, okay? This is what people in relationships do for each other. They help each other, protect each other. You're going to help me get out of here, because you're my girlfriend.
He said it as if it were a curse word.
And because you're my girlfriend, I'll protect your secrets.
My secrets? Rylan whispered.
What you took from Cord. I love you, Rylan. I would never tell on you, no matter how many times they ask me about it.
Rylan felt as though she'd been kicked in the chest. He was threatening her about the stolen spokes. Her eyes flicked up to the walls, feeling dazed. Could the cops be listening to this?
I told you I'm not important enough for them to eavesdrop on, Hirul said, reading her mind.
He leaned back and released her hand. Rylan pulled it into her lap. He'd been holding it so tight her fingers had gone numb.
Okay, I'll help, she said, the words torn forcibly out of her. She didn't have a choice.
Of course you will.
Rylan braced her hands on the table. It felt suddenly like there was no air in the room. The walls closed in on her as if she were the one imprisoned. She couldn't break up with Hirul, at least not yet. She had to stay with him until she got through this and got him out of jail.
Now come give me a kiss, Hirul said, with a nod to his shackled ankles.
Obediently, Rylan stood and walked around the table. She started to brush her lips lightly on his, but Hirul reached up and grabbed her forcibly, his lips hard and unyielding, almost bruising. After a moment, she pulled back. She felt cold all over.
I should get home, she said, and turned to walk back through the guard's room and out the front door.
See you soon,
Hirul called out behind her.
For a few minutes, Rylan walked without even realizing where she was going. Hirul's ugly threat kept replaying in her head. Finally, she stopped in her tracks and wrapped her arms around herself, still trembling uncontrollably. She was standing at the entrance to the A line, the one that went straight up to Cord's place. Why not? She decided. He wouldn't be home till much later anyway. It would be nice to escape for a while into Cord's safe, blackmail-free, upper-floor world. Several hours later, Rylan was curled up on an armchair in Cord's library, with the fireplace hollow turned on and an old Insta-photo book of his mom's in her lap, when she heard a noise in the doorway. "Cord, I'm sorry," she said, only to look up and see Bryce. She hadn't even realized he was back in town.
"Looks like you're working hard," he drawled.
"Cord lets me take breaks," she said defensively. But she knew what it looked like, her making herself at home like this, and he knew it too. Bryce threw up his hands in surrender.
"Far be it from me to criticize. I like jobs with benefits too, you know."
"I don't know what you mean," Rylan said. He took a step forward, and she shrunk back, holding the book in front of her like a shield.
"Listen, why don't you..." "What's going on?"
Cord stood in the doorway. Rylan's heart gave a grateful lurch.
"I was just having a scintillating conversation with our maid here about work ethics."
Bryce winked and slunk out the door. "I'm sorry," Rylan said uncertainly, though why she was apologizing, she wasn't sure.
"Oh, that's just Bryce. He acts all scary, but his heart's in the right place."
"Is it, though?" Rylan thought. She knew that Cord's assholeness was just an act, and she knew where he'd learned it from, but she wasn't so sure with Bryce.
"What are you looking at?"
Cord nodded at the book as he took the seat next to her.
"Nothing, really."
Rylan had been flipping idly through the photos, looking for more images of her mom, though she hadn't found any so far.
"I didn't mean to lose track of time," she added, but Cord waved her protest away.
"I love this room, too."
He glanced around at the shelves of antique books, the floral-printed carpet under their feet, the simulated fire, crackling and emanating heat so convincingly that it seemed real. Rylan looked from the antique clock on the wall to Cord. He was wearing a plain gray t-shirt, and there was dirt caked around the hems of his jeans.
"You skipped school again today?" she asked, though she already knew the answer. "Special occasion," was all he said. Then, "Hey, I haven't seen those pics in forever. Are those of my fourth birthday party? The Aladdin-themed one with the hollow genie?"
Rylan wordlessly held out the photo album, and Cord began flipping through the pages, stopping here and there to point out childhood versions of his current friends, an enormous cake with far more than four candles, a holographic magic show that apparently scared Bryce so much he wet his pants. Rylan nodded from time to time, not really paying attention. In her mind, she was still in that prison visiting room, seeing Hyrule in a new light. Cord had stopped talking and was looking at her expectantly, clearly waiting for an answer to something.
"Oh!" Rylan exclaimed, startled. "That's so...
Cord put his hand over hers.
"Rylan, what's going on?"
Rylan flipped her hand over and laced her fingers in his. She hated that she couldn't be fully honest with Cord. She was trapped by all the lies she'd told, building and building on top of one another like that old party game where you stacked tiles until they fell over. "A friend of mine was arrested. I visited him in jail today," she admitted, telling as much of the truth as she could. "It's got me a little shaken up, to be honest."
"I'm sorry," Cord said.
Rylan gave a helpless shrug.
"What was he arrested for?"
he added after a moment.
"Dealing."
"Did he do it?"
Something about the question put Rylan on the defensive.
"Yeah, he did," she said shortly.
"Well,
you don't get it, okay? You don't understand what it's like down tower, that sometimes you have to do things you don't want to, because you don't have a choice."
"You always have a choice,"
Cord said quietly. Rylan stood up abruptly, closing the Insta-photo album and putting it back on the shelf. A rational part of her knew that Cord was right, but for some reason she was still upset.
Hey, I'm sorry.
Cord came up and wrapped his arms around her from behind.
You've had a rough day. I didn't mean to...
I'm sorry, he said again.
I'm fine, Rylan protested, though she didn't move.
They stood for a while like that, saying nothing. There was something strangely calming about his stillness. Finally, Cord stepped back.
I, for one, am starving, he said, in a clear effort to break the tension. What should we order?
Do you always get delivery?
Well, I'd offer to cook for you, but my skills in the kitchen are limited to frozen noodles and, apparently, making an ass of myself.
You deserve that slap, Rylan said, smiling in spite of herself at the memory. It seemed like a long time ago. Later that night, after they'd eaten, Rylan had insisted on cooking, even wrapping the roast chicken in bacon, which she never could afford to do at home. She curled up on the couch in the living room. She should go back. Carissa would be getting home soon. She'd had late practice all week, with the state tournament coming up. But Rylan felt drained by the spectrum of emotions she'd whirled through today. She needed to rest, just for a minute.
"Do you want to stay?"
Cord asked, his usual confidence faltering a little. Rylan knew what he was asking. She couldn't go there, not yet.
"I need to get home," she said, and gave a huge yawn.
"Can I just... for 5 minutes?" She leaned her head back on the pillow. Cord started to walk away, but Rylan found that she didn't want him to.
"Wait,"
she protested sleepily. He settled next to her, and Rylan shifted so that her back was against his chest. Slowly, her breathing became more regular. Eventually, Cord wriggled off the couch. Rylan was asleep by then, so she didn't see him search for a blanket in the cupboard and tuck it carefully around her. She didn't see him look at her for a moment, studying the way her lashes fluttered in her sleep. She didn't see him lean down and brush back her hair, then kiss her lightly on the brow before heading to his room and shutting the door behind him. But when she woke up in the middle of the night and felt the blanket around her, Rylan snuggled deeper into it and smiled into the darkness. Eris. Eris was lying on the floor of her art history classroom, looking up at the ceiling along with her classmates as they watched a holographic Michelangelo paint the Sistine Chapel. She could hear Avery next to her, sighing each time the painter made another brushstroke. She never understood why Avery loved this stuff so much. It was Avery's fault Eris had enrolled in this class in the first place. Their teacher began lecturing about something. Popes, maybe. But Eris wasn't listening. She moved her purse under her head to get more comfortable. Her eyes drifted to a figure in the corner of the ceiling, holding a scroll and looking anxiously over her shoulder at a painted angel. The girl's hair was the same color as her own. She wondered what Mariel would say about this immersive learning. Probably she would just laugh and roll her eyes and make some comment about how rich people didn't spend their money very well. Eris looked around the room. Gone were the desks and display board and windows. Thanks to an elaborate, incredibly expensive system of holograms and mirrors, every surface was utterly transformed into the 16th century church. Eris wondered, suddenly, how many lower floor families they could feed for the cost of the tech equipment in this room alone. She couldn't wait till this class ended, when she could sneak to the edge of the tech net and see if Mariel had messaged her. They'd spent most of the last week together, ever since Mariel came by Eris's apartment the morning after church.
"Okay,"
Mariel had said simply, and Eris had nodded, and that was that. They'd fallen into an unspoken pattern of meeting up in the evenings when Mariel got off work. Sometimes they would just do homework together, or sit on the couch and watch mindless comedies on the vid screen, or run errands for Mariel's mom, who was a salesperson at a department store. Most of the time, Mariel's mom would insist that Eris stay for dinner. Eris had eaten at their place the past 3 nights. It was nice being part of a family again. The more time Eris spent with Mariel, the more she wanted to keep spending time with her. A high beeping noise cut through the sounds of holographic Michelangelo's humming. A message from the front office, Eris thought, her interest piqued. And then she heard her own name.
Eris Dodd Radson?
The old Eris would have loved this moment, stood up slowly and tossed her hair, letting everyone think she was off somewhere fabulous. But now she just lurched to her feet and grabbed her things. She ignored Avery's whisper and walked quickly out the door to the headmaster's office. The last person she expected to see waiting there was her mom.
Eris!
Caroline exclaimed, striding forward and hugging her. Eris stood there numbly, shocked that her mom was here at school, picking her up.
Let's get going.
Her mom put a hand firmly behind her back and steered her out the school's side door. The headmaster's secretary gave them a fake smile, already turning back to her tablet screen. A hover waited for them on the side of the school.
We can't afford to take a hover.
Eris turned, reminding her mom. But Caroline was already shooing her inside and keying in the destination.
Here, she said, handing Eris a self-steaming garment bag. Change now. We're running late as it is.
Are you serious? Eris asked.
Please, like this is the first time you've changed in a hover, her mom replied.
She had a point. Eris shimmied out of her school uniform and into the sundress inside the bag, her nicest one, a purple Lanvin with big splashes of blue and white. Eris hadn't managed to pack this one before the move. She shot her mom a glance, but Caroline just shrugged.
I got it from storage for you, she said,
and Eris felt a pang of gratefulness. Finally, they pulled up to the paved courtyard of the Lamarck Hotel on 910. Eris still had no idea what was going on.
Mom, she snapped, losing her patience. You can't just pull me out of school and expect me to...
We're here to meet your birth father. The world seemed to go silent, everything spinning dizzyingly around her. Eris couldn't think.
Oh,
she said at last, in a tiny breath. She followed her mom out of the hover into the courtyard. A nearby fountain sprayed water in the shape of a giant cursive L.
After you asked me about him a few weeks ago, I reached out, told him everything.
He wants to meet you. Eris's eyes darted up to the hotel, tears blurring her vision.
He's here?
She whispered. Her mom nodded. He's inside right now. Eris stood there for a moment, uncertain.
Okay, she heard herself say, and knew it was the right thing.
If she didn't meet her birth father now, when he was here, waiting for her, the what-if of it would haunt her forever. Caroline stepped forward. Eris started to pull away, but thought better of it. I've punished her enough, she decided, and accepted her mom's hug.
I love you, Eris, Caroline whispered.
Eris felt dampness on her neck and realized that her mom was crying.
I love you too, Mom, Eris said,
as the wall she'd built between them began to crack, just a little. Eris said nothing as they stepped inside the cool, hushed lobby of the Lamarck, where a white-gloved concierge was speaking with an overweight lady in golf clothes. A little out of the way at 17th and Riverside, the Lamarck was a favorite spot for business people holding secret meetings and, Eris had heard, couples having affairs. Supposedly the president himself used to sneak away to meet his current wife here before he divorced the former first lady. Eris wondered what it meant that her birth father had suggested this place. For some reason it made her feel uncomfortable, as if she and her mom were a sordid little secret.
It's fine, she told herself. He probably just wants privacy.
They walked into the dining room, filled with dark leather banquettes that were so widely separated, it was impossible for someone at one table to see the guests at any other. Eris realized she couldn't hear a single shred of conversation, only the music pumping in over the speakers. Maybe all the tables were equipped with silencers. The hostess, a dark-eyed brunette in a tight uniform skirt, looked them over.
We're the Dodd Radsons, Caroline said, stubbornly using their old name,
or maybe she'd just forgotten the same way Eris kept doing. But the hostess seemed to already know who they were.
This way, she said, weaving through the secluded tables to the back corner. He's been waiting for you.
Eris felt a shudder of apprehension and reached instinctively for her mom's hand. They arrived at the table just as a gentleman stood up from the shadows, and Eris gave a sharp, helpless laugh. She turned to the hostess.
We're at the wrong table. I'm meeting someone else, she said, marveling at the coincidence, because she actually knew this person. It was Matt Cole, Lita's dad.
But the hostess had turned away, and Mr. Cole was clearing his throat.
Caroline, he said, his voice low and hoarse. It's good to see you, as always.
He held out his hand awkwardly.
Eris, thank you for coming.
And she realized, stunned, that there hadn't been a mistake at all. Lita's dad was her dad, too. She and her mom sat down, sliding awkwardly along the banquette so that Eris was between her parents. The silence felt strained and heavy. Mr. Cole was looking at her as if he'd never seen her before, his eyes tracing over her features, probably searching for himself in them. They had similar mouths, Eris realized, and his skin was as fair as hers. But she looked so much like her mom, it was hard to tell. A bot rolled over with a tray of drinks on its surface and began to dole them out.
"I'm sorry I went ahead and ordered," Mr. Cole said self-consciously. "Caroline, the spritz is for you, and Eris, I got you a lemonade. I remember it's your favorite, right?"
She just nodded dumbly. "Yeah, it was my favorite back in eighth grade, the one and only time Lita had me over." They sat there idly swirling their drinks, everyone waiting for someone else to speak. Eris refused to be the first to talk. She was still making sense of all this. A thousand moments were replaying in her mind, the way her mom always asked which other parent would be there before she came to any school function, her seemingly casual questions about Lita, which evidently weren't so casual at all. Now it all made sense. But when? She blurted out, shaking her head in bewilderment. I mean, when did you...
hook up? She didn't know how to phrase the question, but her mom understood.
Matt and I met in our early 20s, Caroline said, watching Eris. Before I met your father. We were part of the same group of friends, all new to the city. The tower was just under construction. Everyone was scattered in the boroughs waiting for it to be done. We were all so poor, she added, turning to Mr. Cole. We were living paycheck to paycheck. Remember how my first apartment in Jersey City had beach towels for curtains?
You couldn't even afford furniture, Mr. Cole said, amusement creeping into his tone. You stacked wooden boxes as your coffee table.
In the summers, when it was hot, we'd sneak into the indoor farmer's market and wander the aisles until they kicked us out, because we couldn't afford air conditioning. Eris looked back and forth between them, totally unnerved by this reminiscing. Her mom smiled softly at the memory, then turned back to Eris, the moment over. Anyway, Caroline said, that's when my modeling career took off. I met Everett, and Matt went back home to Illinois for a while. By the time we saw each other again, it was several years later, and I was married. And so was Mr. Cole, Eris thought. She remembered that he'd picked things back up with Lita's mom, his high school sweetheart, when he moved home to take care of his ailing dad, then convinced her to move with him back to New York, to the brand new tower. God, Mrs. Cole had probably been pregnant with Jamie when they saw each other again. But neither of them mentioned that particular detail.
Well, we reconnected, and then...
Caroline looked at Eris. And then there was you. She looked away, wringing the napkin in her lap until her knuckles were white.
Eris, Lita's dad, her dad, interrupted. I had no idea until your mother called me. I never even guessed that you were mine. As you know, Caroline and I haven't been involved for years now.
He cleared his throat in a businesslike way. Of course, Eris thought. He was still shocked himself.
I want to tell you how sorry I am for everything you're going through, he went on. I imagine this is all incredibly hard on you.
Yeah, it sucks, Eris said dryly. Caroline squeezed her hand.
Please, Mr. Cole said.
Whatever I can do to help, let me know. Eris looked at her mom. Did he know they were on the 103rd floor? What was he going to tell his family? But as she opened her mouth to ask, Mr. Cole tapped on the center of the table, pulling up the holographic menu.
Should we all get some lunch?
He offered hesitantly.
The shishito spring rolls here are amazing. If you have time, that is.
We'd love to, Caroline said firmly. Eris took a long sip of the lemonade she didn't want, her mind still trying to adjust to this strange new reality. Mr. Cole met her eyes across the table and gave a tentative smile. Eris felt herself soften a little. She thought suddenly of when she'd gone to church with Mariel, the way strangers forged a connection with her through nothing but a touch and a look. And this was her birth father, not a stranger at all, trying in his own way to connect with her. Whereas the man who'd been her father for the last 18 years had stopped speaking to her altogether. Lita's dad was her dad. It was pretty much the last thing in the world she'd expected. But he was here, and he was trying. Eris looked up at him and smiled.
Sure, she said, as cheerfully as she could manage.
Lunch sounds great. Lita sat bolt upright, gasping, her silk pajama set drenched in sweat. Her hands wound tightly in her sheets, clutching at them with claw-like fingers. She was having the dreams again. The lights came slowly to life as the room comp detected her alertness. Lita sat huddled in the center of her enormous bed, her arms wrapped around herself. She was shaking. Her limbs felt too heavy to move, like she had shrunk to some miniature creature standing at the controls of an enormous, unwieldy body. She wanted a hit. Desperately. God, she hadn't wanted one this badly since the early days of rehab. Back then she'd had these dreams every night, of drowning in ink-black water, of fingers reaching for her, still and cold as death. I am my own greatest ally, Lita repeated, trying to center herself, but she couldn't. It was freezing in here, and her brain felt muted, and all she wanted was a burst of Zemperhydrin to bring her back to life. When she finally felt like she could move, she threw back the covers and twisted her hair up, heading toward the kitchen. She wanted a glass of water. She could have asked the room comp for it, of course, but she thought walking around might calm her a little. It felt like someone had scraped out her head from within. The apartment was eerily silent. Lita moved a little faster, her bare feet skirting around the squares of moonlight on the floor just like she used to do when she and Jamie were little, and pretended that touching the light was bad luck. In the kitchen, she opened the refrigerator door and stood there a while, letting the cool air kiss her face. Her eyelids were shut, but behind them, almost without realizing it, Lita had drafted a flicker to her old dealer, Ross. It was costing every ounce of her self-control not to send it. Everything was fine, she kept telling herself. Not just fine, it was great. She was going to the benefit with Atlas, no matter that it was costing her friendship with Avery. Well, that was Avery's fault for acting so weird. She deserved Atlas, Lita reminded herself. She deserved to be happy. Her jaw tensed. She turned and started back toward her room, only to stumble over something in the entry hall. She cursed under her breath. It was her dad's briefcase, plopped right where he'd left it when he came home. Lita paused at the sight of a flat orange box peeking from the bag's side pocket. Apparently, her dad had been shopping at Calvador. Her parents' anniversary was in a few days. This must be his present for Lita's mom. Lita didn't feel any scruples about lifting up a corner of the box to see what her dad had gotten. It was exquisite, a cream-colored silk scarf with what looked like hand-stitched embroidery on the edge. She gave a quick verbal command to her contacts, and they looked it up with Shop Match. When she saw how much it cost, Lita gasped. Her dad must be feeling really in love these days. Or really guilty about something. Lita tucked the box away and moved back down the hall. But even after she crawled into bed, she couldn't fall asleep. She felt anxious. She wished she could flicker Atlas, but it was the middle of the night and she didn't want to seem crazy. "What's the latest on Atlas?" she wrote to Nadia instead, not really expecting to hear back right away. Moments later, though, she got a reply. "I have something now, actually." Lita started reading and felt immediately stunned. It seemed that Atlas had been in the Amazon for the last few months, working at some kind of wilderness lodge. Nadia had even attached a few aerial photos as proof, taken by what must have been passing satellites. "You hacked the State Department?" Lita couldn't help asking. These images could only have come from the government comm network. "I told you, I'm the best." Lita lay there in bed, her eyes closed, muttering to her contacts as they projected one image after another for her. The guy in the photos was more deeply tanned, and he had the beginnings of a beard, but it was definitely Atlas. She tossed back and forth, wishing she could fall asleep. Dark, twisted images from the nightmare flitted through her mind. The flicker to Ross was still projected on the inside of her eyelids. God, she wanted to send it. Did anyone else ever feel this way? Alone and frantic, haunted by a fear she couldn't quite place? Did Avery? Lita doubted it. But part of her wondered if Atlas might understand. Maybe he had disappeared last year because he'd been running away from something, too. Something big, if he had to go all the way to the rainforest to escape it. Whatever it was, she wondered if Atlas had ever figured it out. Or if his demons still chased him at night the way hers did. Watt stood outside Norton Harcrow men's attire on the 951st floor, waiting impatiently for Avery. Many social scientists find that nervousness can be reduced by rituals such as counting, especially while picturing an innocuous animal. For instance, sheep. Nadia projected onto his eyes. "I'm not nervous," Watt thought at her, irritated. "You happen to be exhibiting many physiological signs of nervousness, elevated heart rate, sweaty palms." A cartoon sheep overlaid his vision. Watt gave his head a shake to dissolve it. "Can you just be quiet unless I ask you a question?" He self-consciously wiped his hands on the inside of his pockets as a hover pulled up, and Avery stepped out. "Watt!" She tossed her waves of sunflower hair over one shoulder. She had on a simple white dress that showed off her lean, tanned body. A necklace of dark stones glittered distractingly at her neckline. "I'm so glad we're doing this," she said, leading him forward into the store. "Thanks for coming with me," he replied. "And for inviting me to the gala, of course." "We are talking about the same event, aren't we?" she teased. "I mean, I feel kind of guilty for dragging you along. You know how these things can be." "No, I don't. But I don't care. You'll be there." Watt was saved from replying as they passed straight through the solid wooden doors of the store, which, it turned out, weren't solid wood at all, but a location-based hollow that shimmered and reformed after they passed. He looked back over his shoulder and saw that the entrance had now shifted to resemble marble Greek columns. "How weirdly ionic of them," he remarked dryly, just as Avery sighed and said, "I love those doors." Watt felt a flash of guilt. He'd never insulted something that a girl cared about, and Nadia always saved him from this kind of thing. But to his delight, Avery had started laughing at the pun. "I think those are Doric, but nice work," she said with mock seriousness. "Eris and I are in art history this year, you know." "That must be torture for you and Eris, looking at lots of pretty things you're not allowed to buy," Watt ventured, and immediately worried he'd gone too far. He wasn't accustomed to handling this kind of banter alone.
But Avery just laughed again.
You know, no one's ever put it to me quite like that. But you might be on to something.
How is Eris doing, by the way? Watt asked, thinking of the party.
I'm not sure, honestly, Avery said. She left school in the middle of the day today, which can't be good, right?
Watt wished he could offer to help, to look up where Eris had gone if that would calm Avery's fears, but of course that was impossible. As they walked through the store toward the formal section, salespeople at various counters nodded and murmured hellos to Avery, greeting her by name.
"Everyone here seems to know you," Watt said, a bit intimidated.
"I shop a lot."
Avery shrugged.
"It's a men's store,"
Watt couldn't help pointing out. Avery smiled.
"I know."
He followed her past racks of brightly colored ties, belts, and boxers and sleek briefcases to a spacious area marked formal. The walls and floor of this section were a stark industrial white, the space littered with leather chairs and small couches. Watt looked around but didn't see any clothes.
"A little blinding in here, isn't it?"
he pointed out. The white was so bright he almost put his contacts on light blocking. Avery gave him a funny look.
"That's so they can build settings. Didn't they do that at your last tux fitting?"
"Avery, my dear!"
A pale, drawn salesgirl with dark circles around her eyes glided from a back room, the sleeves of her charcoal sweater dipping past her skinny wrists. She looked familiar, but Watt couldn't place her.
"Nadia? Who have you brought for me today? Not Atlas?"
"Rebecca, this is Watt, a friend of mine. He needs a new tux."
Rebecca pursed her lips when she saw Watt, and her eyes narrowed in recognition. She looked a few years older than Watt and Avery, but not many. Hadn't he? "December 11th last year, Anchor Bar. She told you her name was Bex and that she was a freshman at Amherst. She saw you again the next night, but you ignored her to talk to her friend," Nadia informed him.
"Well, that explained why she seemed familiar."
"Let's get started,"
Rebecca said in clipped tones.
"Watt, can you..."
"Oh."
She paused, wrinkling her nose in distaste at Watt, who'd started unbuttoning the top button of his shirt.
"There's no need to disrobe here. We're not at Bloomingdale's."
She shuddered.
"Don't you want to measure me?" Watt asked, and Rebecca barked out a laugh.
"Norton Harcrow took a 4D scan of your body when you walked inside," Avery said gently.
"It's accurate down to the millimeter, and the tux will be made to fit. You know their motto, no alterations needed."
"How is it 4D?
Watt said without thinking, trying to hide his embarrassment.
"They track you each time you come in, keep your measurements updated, let you know how your body's changing over time," Avery explained.
"I know guys who come in here just to track their workout progress." Rebecca began typing on a tablet, and a holographic scan of Watt's body, a big blue silhouette, was projected in the middle of the room.
"What kind of details will you be wanting? Button size? Lining? Lapels?"
Rebecca asked, a little edge to her voice, and looked at Watt expectantly.
"Nadia, where are you?"
"Why don't you set the scene?"
Avery suggested to Rebecca, reading Watt's silence.
"It's for the University Club Gala, so I'd say cherry floors, dim lighting, and the dark walls lined with those terrible white curtains. You know which ones I'm talking about."
"You told me not to volunteer information unless it was requested directly," Nadia answered.
"Well, I take it back," Watt snapped.
Rebecca clicked away at the tablet some more, and instantly the room transformed into the empty dance floor of a distinguished wooden ballroom, with high, narrow windows looking out into the night. A few more taps, and holographic couples in tuxes and floor-length dresses appeared in several small clusters. The silhouette of Watt's body was still hovering there, like a ghostly, headless mannequin. Rebecca nodded, and a black tux materialized on it, the exact size and shape that it would be when it was sewed to Watt's specifications.
"Midnight blue, navy, or black?" she asked.
"Black?"
Watt guessed. He watched as she approached and began moving her hands through the air, pinching her fingers to zoom out or widening them to focus on certain details. She chose the lapel first, scrolling between various widths and textures of silk, glancing from the projection to Watt and back. Formal attire is supposed to be minimalist, to detract attention from the body of the wearer, she was saying, almost under her breath. But you have such a wide chest, I'm thinking you might want a broad-notched lapel to balance you out.
Sure, he said helplessly. Was that supposed to be an insult?
Is your bow tie butterfly or bat-winged?
Nadia had projected a guide to bow tie shapes onto his eyes, but Watt was still floundering. Avery and Rebecca were both looking at him, expectant.
I don't have a bow tie, he said. I mean, it got ruined, too, with my last tux. I need everything.
Understanding flashed in Avery's eyes, and she stepped forward. I like butterfly myself, she said quickly. I prefer more classic styles. What do you think of jetted pocket, cummerbund, and optional suspenders?
That's perfect,
Watt said, grateful, as Rebecca glared at him and made the necessary adjustments to the projection. Watt swallowed when he saw the bill, but he could afford it thanks to all the payments he'd collected from Lita lately, especially the bonus she'd given him for the pics of Atlas in the Amazon. Really, he owed this entire date to Lita, he thought, with a strange amusement. If it wasn't for her, he would never have realized that Avery existed. As he and Avery walked out the front doors, which had now taken the form of old ironwork gates with holographic vines creeping over them, Avery turned to him.
This is your first tux, isn't it? She asked softly.
Nadia offered him an array of excuses, but Watt felt tired of hiding the truth.
It is, he told her.
Avery looked unsurprised.
You didn't have to lie to me, you know.
I didn't lie. At least, not about anything important. I just didn't tell you everything,
Watt hastened to say. He'd told Avery the truth whenever she asked, about how many siblings he had, for instance, or what he liked to do. Whenever she asked a question he didn't want to answer, he had neatly dodged it and let her fill in the blanks with the assumptions he knew she would make. He'd been so proud of himself, but suddenly it did seem a lot like lying.
Actually, I live on the 240th floor, he confessed, then glanced away, unwilling to see her reaction.
What?
Something in Avery's voice made him look up.
That stuff doesn't matter to me. Please don't lie to me again. Too many people lie to me as is. I thought...
She pursed her lips, frustrated.
One of the reasons I like you was that I thought you were actually honest with me.
I am, Watt assured her, thinking guiltily of Nadia and all the information she'd given him on Avery to help his chances. But wait, had Avery just said she liked him?
Oh, no. What?
Avery exclaimed, blushing.
We need to go cancel your tux order.
Why?
She blushed adorably.
Because! Don't you want to go somewhere less expensive? Or you can rent one. I'm sorry, I didn't realize when I suggested Norton Harcrow that you...
I'm getting the tux,
Watt said firmly, and Avery fell silent.
I can buy it, and I want to buy it, and mostly I'm excited for the chance to wear it with you.
Besides, he went on, confident again, I'm hoping this isn't the last gala I get to take you to. Avery smiled at that.
Who knows? Maybe you're right, she said opaquely.
I'll take a maybe for now.
Watt paused on the sidewalk, not wanting this to end.
In the meantime, can I buy you a coffee to thank you for helping me with my first tux?
There's a place down the street that has awesome hemp milk chai and hot coffee, she added, catching his expression. If you don't like hemp milk.
Who wouldn't like hemp milk? Watt said in mock seriousness.
As he followed Avery to the coffee shop, Watt's mind was racing,
thinking over everything she had said, and everything he hadn't. Avery was right. She deserved more than the way he'd been treating her, pretending to be something he wasn't, trying to tell her exactly the right thing. He wasn't just trying to sleep with her. Well, he amended, he wasn't only trying to sleep with her. So why was he acting like it? What he really wanted was to pursue Avery. For real. And so Watt made a decision he'd never made before. He would stop using Nadia when he and Avery were together. See you later, Nadia, he thought, then sent the command that would power her all the way down. Quant off. He felt the sudden emptiness like a sound, or rather a lack of sound, like the silence that echoed after a summer storm. He hadn't turned her off since the day she was installed in his head. "Here it is," Avery said, pushing open the door and looking back over her shoulder at Watt. Her eyes were so startlingly blue it almost took his breath away. "I hope you're ready for the best coffee you've ever tasted."
"Oh, I'm ready," Watt said, and followed her inside.
Rylan. Saturday afternoon, Rylan stood outside the 50th floor entrance to lift maintenance, steeling herself. She could do this, she told herself. She had no other choice. Pasting a smile on her face, she walked in the metal double doors and winked at the craggy old security guard behind the plexiglass sign-in counter. He grunted, barely looking up as she sailed past, recognizing her from all the time she'd been here with Hyrule. Technically, only lifties were allowed past this point, but Rylan had seen plenty of their significant others in the locker room before, delivering forgotten items or cleaning out dirty laundry. The locker room was musty and smelled like stale sweat and grease. Rylan walked confidently to the far side, past two guys in the corner who were stripped to the waist, playing some game on their tablets to kill time. They were the skeleton weekend crew, on call in case of emergencies. Moving quickly, she punched in the passcode to Hyrule's locker and swung the door open. Hyrule was a climber, one of the guys who actually hung from a wire in midair while the rest of the crew manned the operation from the tunnel above. A job that took courage, or maybe just blind hubris. Because of that, he had a full-length locker in a prime location near the exit door. She pushed aside his dark gray swingsuit, made of a thin but nearly impenetrable carbon composite fiber, and his heavy-duty Ecrimold helmet, which supposedly could prevent brain damage from a fall of up to 200 stories. Not often useful, given that most repairs were needed in the upper floors, where altitude and cable strain led to lift closures. Under Hyrule's climbing boots and magnetic grip gloves, Rylan found what she was looking for, the tiny ID chip that snapped into place on his helmet.
"You shouldn't be in here."
She whirled around, shoving the ID chip the only place she could think of, in the crevice of her bra. "I'm sorry," she said to the young man who stood before her, his burly arms crossed. "I'm getting some things for Hyrule Karajan."
"The kid who got picked up for drugs?" he growled.
Kid? This guy couldn't be more than a few years older than Hyrule. But she just nodded as she said, "Yeah, I'm his girlfriend."
"I've seen her here before," the other guy called out from the corner. "Leave her alone, Nuru."
But Nuru stood there watching as Rylan grabbed the first thing she could think of, Hyrule's high-pitched silent whistle, as if that mattered at all to him in prison, and slammed the locker shut. "Sorry, I'll be going," she mumbled. As she hurried out, she could hear them talking in low tones behind her. Most of the words were too quiet for her to make out, but she heard, "Damn shame," and, "Shouldn't do that to her," and she thought she heard V's name mentioned. She wondered, suddenly, if they hadn't been fooled at all by her excuse. She made her way hastily to the C local train and got off on 17, wrinkling her nose at the smell of oily machinery. It had been a while since Rylan went lower than 32. She'd almost forgotten how depressing it was down here. The bottom 20 floors housed most of the tower's cooling facilities,
with dim warrens of rooms crowded in the spaces between. The walls were thicker down here, and the ceilings lower, lined with the triple-enforced steel that supported the unthinkable weight of the tower over their heads. The lift was mostly empty. Still, Rylan waited for everyone else to filter off, turning toward the machine rooms or their dismal apartments. When the coast was clear, she fished Hyrule's ID chip from where it was nestled in her cleavage and used it to open the tiny, almost invisible door on the corridor marked Maintenance Only. It was utterly black inside, the darkness pressing down on her like a weight. Rylan fumbled for a light button. She found it, then hesitated. She couldn't risk drawing any kind of attention to herself. Maybe someone, somewhere, could see what lights were on throughout the maintenance areas and would notice that the lifty tunnel on 17 was occupied when it shouldn't be. Cursing under her breath, she unearthed her tablet and put it in flashlight mode. A thin beam of light blinked into being. Rylan waved it before her, stepping carefully over the boxes on the floor until she found the mech panel on the left-hand side. Biting the tablet with her teeth to keep the light steady, she pried the panel open. There they were, dozens of plastic baggies filled with multicolored powders, pill bottles whose contents she didn't even recognize, and, at the back, the dark envelopes of Cord's spokes. Rylan stood a moment in sick shock. She was trembling, causing the tablet's light to dance wildly over the panel as if she were some messed-up version of an explorer standing over a pile of buried treasure. She'd taken drugs so many times with Hyrule, and yet the sight of all this stuff was sobering. He'd become a complete stranger to her. How long had he been squirreling things away here? She swung her empty backpack off her shoulder and began filling it, tossing handfuls inside as fast as she could. But she froze at the sight of Cord's name on the spokes packets in small capitals at the top of each individual prescription label. Dr. Veronica Fiss, Columbia Hill Pharmacogenomics, patient Cord Hayes Anderton Jr., dosage as needed, max one tablet daily. Quickly she peeled Cord's name from each label and shoved the sticky paper into her pocket, where she wadded it into a tiny ball. Then she zipped the bag back up and closed the mech panel, carefully, using the hem of her shirt so she didn't leave fingerprints, before retreating into the hallway. On the lift up tower, she pulled out her tablet and replied to the message she'd received earlier this week. It's done. Excellent. Meet here. There was a location drop attached to the message. Rylan reached to put her hair up in a ponytail, trying her best to look like a normal high schooler, just walking around on Saturday with a backpack full of homework. Following the message's instructions, she got out on the 233rd floor. An old woman bumped into her as she stepped off the lift, and Rylan reflexively pulled the straps of her backpack closer over her shoulders. The lights overhead were dimming as the day grew later. It must be at least 6 o'clock by now. Rylan passed a few laundromats and takeout noodle shops, turning onto High Street ahead. The location drop led to Fisher Elementary School. Really? She slowed as she walked past, a little creeped out by the dark, empty windows of the school leering at her. "Glad you could make it," she heard V say from the playground. Rylan looked both ways before climbing the low-tech metal fence. Her hands were white by the time she jumped to the other side. "I'm here," she said, glancing around the monkey bars, where during recess holographic monkeys would clamber alongside the kids. A treetop canopy soared overhead, dotted with treehouses that resembled whimsical shapes like a tortoise shell or a giant cloud. This was way nicer than her own elementary school had been, just 70 floors down. Rylan's shoes sank into the recycled rubber covering the ground. V stepped forward from the shadows, an impish smile dancing across his face. "Why couldn't we have just met at the Steel Forest?" she asked, but V shook his head. "Too many people. Now let's see it. What do you have for me?" Rylan shrugged off her backpack but held it tight. She didn't like the feel of this at all. Her deep-rooted survival instincts were stirring, warning her that something wasn't right. "I need to get paid first." "Let's just see what you've got." V laughed and snatched the backpack from her grasp. Rylan ground her jaw angrily as he dumped the contents of the backpack onto the playground and sorted through it.
"You've taken the name off these spokes," he said, an eyebrow raised.
She struggled to keep her face impassive. "You know it doesn't matter. No one gives a shit who their spokes were originally prescribed to."
"Trying to protect him?"
Rylan's breath caught. She opened her mouth to say something, to deny any feelings for Cord.
"Whatever. You're right. It won't, really. You don't know where Hero got these, though, do you?"
V asked with a sidelong glance.
"He never did tell me."
Rylan shook her head, feeling stunned. Hero had told V that he was the one stealing the spokes? He must have done it to protect her. V swept all the drugs into his bag and gave a dramatic sigh.
"I'm sorry, but this isn't enough."
"What do you mean it's not enough?" V shook his head.
"I can't give you $15,000 for this. It's barely worth $10,000.
"You lying little—" Rylan lunged forward, but V put his hands out and grabbed her shoulders, squeezing them so hard that Rylan felt she was running into a wall. He gave her a little shove and she stumbled back, her breath still coming fast.
"Come on, Rylan," V muttered, shaking his head.
The ink tats around his neck looked almost darker with his anger.
"Play nice."
She stayed mutinously silent.
"Now about the extra $5,000.
His eyes traveled over her in a way she didn't like.
"You and I could always just strike up a little trade of our own."
"Go to hell, V."
"Thought you'd say that. But for some reason, I like you. So I'm giving you one last chance. Tell Hurl he needs more spokes," V demanded, his words unyielding. "At least 5 more. You'll have to grab them since he's locked up."
"No!" Rylan shouted, clenching her hands, feeling sick. "I won't do it, okay?" V shrugged.
"I don't care one way or the other. But it's my final offer. Take it or leave it, Myers. Now get the hell out of here."
He muttered something under his breath, and the school's security alarm went off. Rylan stood there in stunned bewilderment. But V had already taken off, ducking through a gate she hadn't seen on the far side of the playground. An instant later, Rylan's reflexes kicked in and she was running through the gate, sprinting headlong down the empty length of Maple Street. V was nowhere to be seen. Rylan kept running, so fast that she tripped over her own feet and fell forward, skidding angrily along the unforgiving pavement. But she picked herself back up and hurried on, adrenaline dulling the pain in her hands and knees, not daring to stop until she turned onto the main avenue. Finally, Rylan bent down and examined her knees. They were badly skinned, and blood was smeared on her palms where she'd fallen. Taking a deep, ragged breath, she started the long trip home. Avery.
"I've got it!"
Avery called out when the entrance comm buzzed later that night. Not that her parents were the type of people who answered their own door, but she wanted to give Watt a moment to collect himself before he met them, since they'd all be sharing a hover to the university club. Atlas had already left to pick up Lita, which Avery was trying not to think about.
"Watt!"
she said, flinging open the front door, and paused at the sight of him in his new tux. The elegant satin clung to his frame, making him seem taller than he really was, highlighting the strong, clean lines of his nose and jaw and the burnished brown of his skin.
"It looks great on you,"
she said, her heart beating unexpectedly faster. "The tux, I mean."
"It was fun shopping for it."
It was fun, wasn't it? Avery thought.
"I got you something, by the way."
Watt cleared his throat and held out a small velvet box.
"Oh, you didn't have to—"
Avery trailed off as she opened the box. Inside was a miniature incandescent, one of the genetically engineered flowers that attracted light the way magnets attract metal. Already it was drawing some of the light from the room toward it, taking on a sort of ghostly glow,
though it generated none of the light itself. Incandescents were funny. They'd become much cheaper since they were first bred decades ago.